News Talk Sunday.
A fascinating meeting will take place, certainly scheduled to take place. A man called David Ryan, who was exposed to abuse linked with Blackrock College, is set for a private audience and meeting with Pope Leo tomorrow, presumably in the Vatican, where he'll be asking lots of tough questions about how the church buried abuse in that institution, but also in many other places and context over many decades. And joining me here in studio is abuse survivor and campaigner Colm O'Gorman, who of course you know him from being director of 1&4 on previous and various other bodies. Colm, you're very welcome to the studio on this
morning.
It's great to have you along. Now, this, as I said in my intro, is a unusual meeting, not completely unprecedented in the sense the Pope and Pope Francis did meet abuse survivors, like it has happened, but in an Irish context it is a powerful meeting. Are you pessimistic, optimistic? How do you view it overall, this meeting with David Ryan going to?
Well, first of all, I think it's a very personal and important meeting for David. I know David and I've been talking to him over the last couple of weeks as well, and it's a very significant meeting for him. He would have first written, I think it would have been to Pope Francis actually. Some listeners might know David's story. David and his brother Mark have been really at the fore over the last couple of years of bringing and revealing and exposing and moving forward investigations into the handling of abuse in schools by the Spiritan Order. And David had said to Mark, Mark died tragically a couple of years ago of a heart attack, and David had said to Mark that he was going to write to the Pope, and Mark thought he was crazy. What's the point in that? But for, I know from talking to David, for him it's really important that he hands responsibility in some ways for this, you know, looks to see how Pope Leo might respond to this, how the Vatican will respond to this. So I think it's very important for him. It's unprecedented in his context and in the context of these cases. So I don't think it's about whether or not popes have met with survivors before. They have. I mean, and Irish survivors, Mary Collins, the extraordinary Mary Collins, for some time was part of the Vatican's Commission on Child Abuse until she resigned from that because she lacked confidence in the body itself. And indeed, popes have over many years met with survivors of abuse, including Pope Francis when he visited Ireland. Under some pressure, he finally...
Yeah, and I suppose the unknown element here is Pope Leo is a reasonably new pontiff. He's seen generally the coverage of him is... He's seen as a more liberalising force than some of the other candidates that might... I know that's with a small L in terms of the institution we're talking about, but he's seen as a more liberalising force than other potential popes that could have been elected. So in that context, it's kind of a bit of a leap into the unknown. We don't know much about how this man is going to handle these things, do we?
Well, we might not know much about how this man is going to handle these things, but we know an awful lot about how the Vatican has handled these things.
As an institution.
Yeah, as an institution, and how the papacy as an institution and as an office has handled these things going back not just decades now, but many centuries. And I mean, Pope Francis was seeing as, and Leo was seeing as being, you know, in his style or in his general approach or of his same philosophy. Pope Francis did not cover himself in glory in how he managed this issue. I mean, one listeners might recall when he was coming to Ireland, we were being told that he wasn't going to even deal with or acknowledge the abuse issue when he was here, until there was understandable public uproar and huge global attention on that. But he was coming when he was coming here, he said he knew nothing, for instance, about the mother and baby homes, which was nonsense. I mean, it's ridiculous to suggest that he didn't. So sadly, what we generally see is popes at best minimising both what they knew and about the scale of what had happened, but more often they're not actually lying about it. And I mean, Pope Francis was no different in that regard. So, you know, the Vatican's not good at this. The Vatican, you know, when all of these stories started to emerge, like when I was coming forward in the mid-1990s, the Vatican was dismissing that abuse even happened. It was describing victims as fantasists. It was describing victims as the problem. It was blaming victims very often for the abuse, saying that they had corrupted priests, even when they acknowledged that things had happened. Benedict, for instance, when he was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, said that the whole thing was a media conspiracy against the church, that this was an effort to do the church down. So we've had decades of deceit and dishonesty.
Do you see them? They have moved from that sort of language, but is it tactical? In other words, is it sort of like, that's not great messaging?
They've moved from that language to... we acknowledge the terrible things that were done to some children by some priests.
Then
we acknowledge that some bishops didn't manage these allegations properly, to then talking about putting in place some kind of measures to require bishops to deal with them differently. But all of that ignores the simple fact that bishops, you know, when bishops covered up abuse, they weren't mismanaging cases. They were following canon law and the direction of the Vatican. The cover-up of these crimes was directed by the Vatican, underpinned and enforced by canon law, going back many, many decades. So every acknowledgement that the Vatican has made under enormous pressure, very often, and it takes decades for them to do it, continues to be, frankly, just a deceit. Now, so no Pope has acknowledged the fact that a cover-up happened, that it was willful, that it was deliberate, that it was designed, as countless legal inquiries in this country and in other places have clearly identified and found, that it was designed to protect the institution, its clergy, its authority.
So what you're
money.
Describing, it sounds a bit like kind of a, you know, kind of metal fist in a velvet glove type of thing. Like, in other words, the packaging slightly changed, you know, the it's a softer message externally, but if you get into negotiating with them or talking to their lawyers or whatever, it's pretty unappetizing.
Best way I can respond to that, I suppose, is when I came forward in early 1995 to report what had happened to me, I thought I was going to the guards to report one bad man who happened to be a priest who had done terrible things to me when I was a, you know, 14, 15 and 16 year old. Within weeks, I found out that he had been doing this for an awful lot of other people. Within about 6 months, I found out that the diocese had known before they ordained him as a priest.
So the layers and started, like an onion. Yeah,
within 18 months, I found out that the Vatican had received complaints about him and done nothing. So when I started a legal action, when I decided to sue the Pope, which I did in 1998, it was because I wanted to get the truth of what had happened. I wanted the truth to be established. Justice matters. The truth matters. If we were to respond to terrible crimes, particularly systemic crimes like this, the first thing we have to do is get to the truth of it, have people take responsibility for their role in it, and then make the kind of systemic changes necessary to ensure that that never happens again. It's not rocket science. No. And that's never happened because the Vatican has refused to tell the truth, has refused to accept that this is systemic and directed by them, and certainly has refused to ever be accountable. So we're still dealing with that situation 40 years later.
Fitting into that background, then, David is going to meet the Pope. Now, he's coming from a particular position where the abuse, as I understand, I haven't read his case in detail, but it's happening in an institutional school setting, right? Boarding school and so on. And, you know, thousands of listeners listening in know Blackrock College and all the rest of it. So the fact that the Pope is choosing to meet David, and presume he's not meeting other people, in other words, he's not meeting everyone that he gets a letter from. So, and I don't want to be deeply cynical, it's not my position to be, and David is rightfully saying this works for me and I want to do this. But is there people who might be listening in saying, well, why did the Pope pick this particular meeting? Why now? All of those kind of questions.
Well, I mean, on another level, why not, right? I mean, it's appropriate and I think right and proper that the Pope should meet David and respond to what David has to say to him. I mean, David first came forward back in 2003 with Mark. I mean, when we had just set up 1&4, David was one of the first people that we met with. And David went through exhaustive processes, both in terms of criminal and civil law, and got nowhere because he was blocked at every point from achieving justice. So it's important from that perspective. It's also important to note that, you know, from 2001 onwards, the Vatican had rules in place that required every case or every allegation of abuse by a cleric to be referred to them, and that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which at the time was headed by Joseph Ratzinger, who went on to become Pope Benedict, would have exclusive competence in deciding how these cases should be handled. So even under canon law, as it was accepted quite late in the day, the Vatican had a clear responsibility and must have had knowledge of David's case and of David's complaints. So it will be interesting to see how Pope Leo responds to that. Am I expecting some big breakthrough moment? Frankly, no. It's difficult not to be cynical about how the Vatican will respond to this when you've been involved in this battle for 30 years and you see the same old deceit and dishonesty and spin and manipulation time and time again. I very, very much hope it's different. But at the very least, I really hope that it's meaningful for David, because that's the least he deserves.
Now, in all your campaigning work, you've dealt with presumably a load of different orders, right? So, you know, from nuns, from priests, like the Spiritans in this case, I won't go through all the names, right? Do you notice much difference in how they respond? Are they all very standardized, regardless of what they are? Have you noticed, no, they resist more, these don't open up any documents, you're wasting your time trying to do, like, is there a difference? Because that would give a sense, an idea of that systematic thing. Then
it's hard to identify an example of an order that got it all right, but then very few people get everything right. And of course there are different responses. I mean, some listeners will remember, for instance, over the last year there's been a lot of concern about the way that the Christian Brothers were using the legal system to nuisance and harass people who were coming forward making complaints and making justice impossible for them. So there are still examples of orders who continue to play that game. But the critical thing in this, Emmet, and this is why the focus on the Vatican is, I think, important in the moment, is that what you have is a system of cover-up and collusion that was directed and underpinned by canon law, which is developed and enforced by the Vatican. So, you know, too often we get caught up in the idea that, well, you know, this bishop did this wrong, or this order did this. Like this, the cover-up of these crimes is global, it's systemic, it's church-wide, it's directed by the Vatican, and it's underpinned by church law. Like the first laws to deal with priests who committed sexual crimes or sexual offences were introduced in the church in 311 AD by the Council of Elvira, right? So this goes back a very, very long time indeed. And yet in the mid-1990s, when all of this was being revealed and the Vatican were being challenged, they were saying that, well, we didn't even know such a thing was possible. So the level of deceit, the level of blatant deceit and cover-up on the part of the Vatican is something that we need to be ruthlessly focused on. And it blows my mind that people still struggle to acknowledge that simple fact. It seems too much for people to believe that the Vatican, that the Pope, that the Holy See, that successive popes would willfully, deliberately, consistently lie and mislead about the nature of this cover-up, even when it's been proven as a matter of legal fact. But nevertheless, they do.
Now, can I talk to you about another audience which we haven't touched upon at all, but people who have children in school today, and there's all sorts of safeguarding legislation and all, and they're listening into this item, and I'm not going to get into current school practice and all that, but when they hear these type of stories in David's meeting and all the rest of it, should they sort of say, yeah, that's interesting, and that poor man, and its history and all the rest of it, or should they say, we're not happy with current conditions. We're not happy with the way this whole issue is still policed. Or is it wrong to connect those to the past and today?
I mean, it's never wrong to connect the past and today if we can see how the past impacts today. Like history only becomes history when it's no longer relevant to today, right? And yet history impacts very often on many of the things that we do today and how we build and develop systems. One of the real big breakthroughs, and it shouldn't be, but it's important to acknowledge it, of the last 30 years is that, you know, when I was campaigning for the Ferns Inquiry in 2003, where we're being told that this had nothing to do with the state and the state had no business investigating the church, as if these kinds of crimes and the cover-up of these crimes and the failure of state institutions like the Gardaí, like the then health boards, to address this from a child protection or criminal law perspective was none of the state's business. We're now at the point where the state could never suggest, and nobody would ever suggest, that that's a matter for the church to deal with. Child protection, the protection of people's human rights, the vindication of those rights, responding when those rights are being violated, is the responsibility of the state. The state has obligations under national law, on international law, to respond to these kind of crimes when they happen, but also to try to ensure that they don't happen in the first instance. So should we be happy or satisfied with levels of child protection practice in this country? No, we should never be satisfied with that, because child abuse will always be a phenomenon, and we always need to make sure.
Yeah, but I hear you saying almost equally we can't be, you know, pious and not recognise that some progress has happened as well. Right?
Significant progress has happened, but we've a long, long way to go. I mean, it is a tragedy that because Catholic theology and the church's power and the church's approach to these issues directed so much of social policy in this country for a very, very long time indeed. It's a real tragedy that the church's detailed understanding of the nature of paedophilia didn't inform the development policy here. And that for most of the history of the state, we wouldn't even acknowledge that such things were possible or were happening in the first instance. We're beyond all of that now. We know that child abuse happens. We know about the prevalence of child abuse. I mean, when I founded 1 in 4, it was called 1 in 4 for a reason.
Yes.
And that was because all of the research told us that 27% of people in Ireland experience child abuse, child sexual abuse as children.
Okay.
So we know that it's endemic across society. We know that we need to respond to
Colm,
respond.
Thank you very much. Good luck to David Ryan with that meeting scheduled to happen tomorrow with Pope Leo. It's going to be a fascinating, unusual, not completely unprecedented, but certainly in an Irish context, an unusual event. Let's hope something positive emanates from it, Colm. Thank you very much.
News Talk Sunday.